This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
World experts just gathered in Geneva at the High Mountain Summit. The problem? Up to half of the world's people get their water from mountains, but that is threatened by a changing climate. Dr. John Pomeroy is a Canadian expert on hydrology and co-chair of that summit. Pomeroy is director of Global Water Futures and leads many other institutions, including as Canada Research Chair in Water Resources and Climate Change. We reach John at his home University of Saskatchewan in Canada. From Saskatoon, John Pomeroy, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, Alex. Pleased to be on.
In 2013, I went to visit family in Calgary, Canada, and large parts of the city had just flooded. It was epic. Please talk to us about that flood and what we learned from it.
Well, that was a very interesting event. I was further up the river from where you were, near Canmore, Alberta, and we had about 15 research scientists out there taking measurements of the hydrology, and then the storm hit. And it was fascinating because there was a substantial late-season snowpack. Even though it was late June, there was still a lot of snow up high in the mountains. And so much of the rain fell on the snow, carried with it lots of energy, which melted the snow very rapidly. It's called a rain-on-snow melt event, and they're famous for causing floods. And that contributed to the flooding. So there was roughly 250 millimeters of precipitation that fell during the event, but another 100 millimeters in many areas of snowmelt added to that. And it came very quickly. And also, the flows were not just water, but it was debris mixed in with the stream flow. So the debris it carried was highly destructive and destroyed river channels, stream channels, bridges, wiped out the Trans-Canada Highway, the Canadian Pacific Main Line that goes east-west across Canada, and then carried on downstream. The reason the debris was in there is partly because of deglaciation in the mountains. Many glaciers above the front ranges had receded over the last few decades and left vast amounts of rubble and boulders ready to be washed away. So, you know, you could almost say deglaciation loaded the gun, and then the rain was the firing that caused all this to come down. It ended up being the most expensive natural disaster in Canadian history to that time, $6 billion of damage. Much of downtown Calgary was flooded. Other smaller towns and cities around there, Canmore, High River, a few others were severely impacted. But when we looked at it statistically, three events of this magnitude are typically expected to occur in every century. So you'd argue a return period of about 1 in 35 years, not that high. So we should have been prepared for it, and we should have had an early warning system to give substantial warning that this event was coming. In fact, in Canmore, the forecast that the rivers would be flooding came after the evacuations had already started.
So a lot of my listeners don't live near the mountains, and why would they care about what happens with mountain water?
Well, this is just one example, but you know, Calgary is 100 kilometers east of the mountains, and yet still affected by a mountain flood. But rivers that drain the mountains supply water to over half of humanity around the world. In Asia, you know, the Ganges, the Indus, the Yellow, the Yangtze, the Mekong, all drain out of the Hindu Kush, Himalaya, and Tibetan Plateau region. Similarly, in the United States, the Colorado, famously, the Missouri, the Columbia, all drain out of the mountains. And as you go to Europe, the Rhine, the Rhone, the others, Danube, coming out of the mountains. Even further Australia, the Murray Darling has some important headwaters in these snowy mountains. So there are a disproportionate amount of stream flow generated in high mountain regions. And this is also where climate change impacts are seen most profoundly. We get some enhanced climate warming at high elevations. We're losing the snow and ice up there. So we call that snow and ice together the cryosphere. And but we're losing it rapidly as temperatures warm up. And, of course, then, these are the headwaters of our rivers. So all this change is occurring upstream from where much of the human population lives and where we produce our food is downstream of these mountain regions. So what happens there affects everyone on the planet, the viability of our cities, our ability to generate electricity through hydropower, our ability to grow food through irrigation. And you can even argue that the earliest human civilizations in the Indus, Tigris, Euphrates, Thales, the Yellow River, were all based upon managing water from mountains.
So you just co-chaired the High Mountain Summit at the World Meteorological Organization in Geneva. Why have a summit?
Well, there has been a focus on climate change in the polar regions. We hear lots about Greenland and Antarctica and the ice sheets melting. And these are very, very serious problems causing sea level rises. We hear less about what's occurring in the high mountains. For instance, the melt of mountain glaciers is contributing to sea level rise. We can expect as much as a third of a meter of sea level rise from mountain glaciers. And the mountain glaciers are melting right now. We've already lost hundreds of thousands of these around the world. And in any particular mountain range, hundreds to thousands. So this is going on as we speak. And it's also something that is manageable because we manage the water supplies coming from the mountains. So there are things that we can do about it. There are solutions that we can find to some of the problems that this raises. And that made it a very important focal point for the UN to focus its efforts.
And it's so difficult to see what will happen. I mean, on one hand, large parts of the Earth will get drier, but the atmosphere overall will get wetter, and then we have extreme precipitation events popping up, whether it falls as rain or snow. It's hard to see how you can predict any one thing about what's going to happen in the high mountains.
Well, one thing is that many of our weather models were designed to, provide a good forecast for a level place, I think Kansas in the United States or other areas that are fairly simple topography. And these models don't do very well in the mountains. One saying in the Canadian Rockies, if you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes. It changes rapidly, but also changes over short distances. And so we need high-resolution atmospheric models in order to predict the weather, but also to look at changes to climate that might occur over long periods of time. And this is one of the things that the High Mountain Summit was calling for, is that we have to develop these models so we have some better predictability of what is occurring and will be occurring in the mountains.
Well, there is some new dam construction. The Three Gorges Dam in China is fairly recent. There's others on the go in Asia. But in general, most of the world's big hydro dams were built in the 1900s. Why does it matter when the dams were built?
Yes, the climate and the hydrological regime when those dams were built has changed substantially already and will be changing further over the next few decades. So in the 20th century, the high mountains had most of their precipitation generally as snowfall, and they would store it up over the winter, and spring would come and snow would melt, and then the dams would store that water to make hydroelectricity when there is demand for it, or to store it until such time as farmers needed water for irrigation. And often that was not a very long time. So they might store the water in April and May from runoff and then use it for irrigation in June and July. But without the snowfall, with mountain rainfall, which is what we're seeing more and more of, then the precipitation might be occurring in January and have to be stored until June or July. So now we're looking at 6 months of storage, which the dams weren't designed for. And also, when you get a heavy precipitation event under a colder climate that we used to have, it would come a snowfall. We call that good skiing. When we have that heavy precipitation as rainfall under a warmer climate, it can be a disastrous flood. So the dams and structures that we built may not be able to withstand those extreme events.
Is mountain water involved in the growing phenomenon of large cities actually running out of potable water? We've seen more news stories about that in the past year or two.
Well, some of Cape Town's water was, in fact, from highland, upland areas, for sure. It wasn't really the high mountains, per se. It's become an issue more in Asia, where you have 1.6 billion people living off the waters from the Himalayas, the Hindu Kush, and those areas. And there are certainly communities in the Himalayas that are experiencing extreme drought right now and will have to relocate. So that's already happening to some of them. In terms of the impact on the large cities, so far the mountains have been sufficiently reliable to maintain them. But there are problems coming in the Andes in very short order, and in the rivers that drain the Hindu Kush, particularly the Indus River, will have already has problems, and they'll become much more severe. And the issues with those two types of river basins is that they have glaciers, which is great, but the glaciers melt during the dry season, and when there aren't other sources of water to form stream flow, and the glaciers are shrinking rapidly. So without the glaciers, that dry season will be absolutely arid in terms of stream flow, whereas right now they're is enough water to supply the cities and the irrigation in that area, in those areas.
Once those glaciers are gone, they're gone. So I have seen several news stories, even this fall, of glaciers about to burst or floods coming out of the mountains in the Alps of Switzerland and Italy. Are you expecting more sort of news disasters coming because we don't know enough about mountain water supplies and how to manage them?
Yes, unfortunately, yes. As the glaciers retreat, they start to physically disintegrate, and sometimes that can cause them to dam up water and form a lake that's dammed by the ice, and then the ice continues to melt and the lake is released very quickly. These are called GLOFs, glacial lake outburst floods, and they tend to kill a lot of people when they happen, often, sometimes up to thousands. They occur without warning and can be devastating, just like having a dam burst when it's a human-made dam. But they are detectable using satellite remote sensing, and it is possible to develop early warning systems for these, and such systems would save vast numbers of lives.
And when I look at a long list of groundbreaking studies you co-authored, where very few people looked before, I suspect that may come partly from your roots in the Canadian Prairie Province of Saskatchewan. Why does Saskatchewan need to know a lot about water?
Well, Saskatchewan is a long way from the Rockies. It's 700 to 800 kilometers from Saskatoon to the Rockies, depending how you drive, but it's a semi-arid province. It actually receives very little precipitation itself, and it's a food-producing province, so it'll grow lots of grain. The other thing is that groundwater supplies are not very reliable in Saskatchewan, so people, if they can, use the rivers for their water supply, and the rivers come from the mountains. In fact, the South Saskatchewan River in the city of Saskatoon, where I live, about 80 to 90% of its stream flow comes from the Rocky Mountains. So these rivers provide water to a parched land, and that water is used for the cities, it's used for potash mines, it's used for irrigation. It's piped hundreds of kilometers away from the rivers in some cases, and it's used for hydroelectric power. So it's absolutely makes life in the Canadian prairies far better and more dynamic than it would have been without.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. With us is a senior scientist, hydrology expert, Dr. John Pomeroy from the University of Saskatchewan, Canada. And John, you were part of a 10-year international effort to develop and share water information from river basins where nobody measures the water flows. And I was thinking, well, that must mean less developed countries, maybe in Africa. But then I'm thinking, there must be vast amounts of water running around in northern Canada without being monitored. Where are these ungauged basins, as you call them?
Oh, you've hit it on the head. Northern Canada is very sparsely gauged. There aren't many stream flow gauges because of the remoteness of the rivers, the lack of roads, and it's very expensive to put a stream gauge there when you have to maintain it, visiting by helicopter, things like this. So Canada shares the experience of having vast parts of its territory ungauged with countries that might be in the what's traditionally called the developing world or less developed world. And we've also at times, when we've had budget cutbacks at the federal government level or provincial government levels, we've lost gauging networks. And it's often the most remote north that we lose. So we've had to develop techniques to estimate stream flow without a gauge. That's quite useful. It's a very difficult thing to do, but it's a very, very useful thing to do. And it's a sort of technology that's also useful to countries that for various reasons have not been able to maintain or afford to continue their stream gauging networks.
And on top of that lack of basic data when it comes to water, you also talk about unwillingness to publish or share information because of security concerns. Can you talk to us about an example or two?
Well, there are unfortunately many around the world. The world's nations have a very good record of sharing weather data, primarily because of aviation, but other reasons as well. But water data is seen as proprietary. Sometimes it's because of a hydroelectric utility that its business depends on the stream flow, and so they may not want others to know too much about its business. There may be other concerns. Many river basins travel from one country to another, and so there isn't always cooperation on sharing that data about what's coming downstream, in particular what's been used upstream. But without that information, that basic information on water, we can't work out ways to share it equitably and fairly. And we also need these for flood forecasting systems. If a flood is moving downstream from one country, the countries downstream need to know that as soon as possible. So there's many, many reasons to share the data. And there are good examples, but there are also many examples where we don't know very much. But this is where satellites can come in. And there are new satellites that will be up in a year or two, one called SWOT, which can measure the height of a river from space. And then that's going to revolutionize things because it will no longer be possible to not share the levels in a stream.
John Pomeroy, you've produced so much in your career. I developed a short list of important topics that probably need half an hour each, but let's try and touch on a couple. And one that really interests me is snow contaminants. What is that about?
Well, it's snow chemistry. And, you know, we always think of snow coming down as white, as pure, pure as the driven snow. And nothing could be further than the truth. The snow is a great scrubber. The snowflakes coming down pick up aerosols and other contaminants from the atmosphere, and they can hold them over the winter. And then also contaminants, pollution is deposited on the snow over the winter, over the many months that we might have a snow-covered season. And so slowly accumulates snow that way. And then you get strange things going on. Several years ago, I had the opportunity to study blizzards in the Scottish Highlands, and the blowing snow particles there develop an electrical charge that attracts aerosols to the particles, a bit like an electrified scrubber air cleaner. And so you, at that time, this is the 1980s, would develop a gray to black blowing snowstorm with a pH of 2.6. It was acidic. It would burn your eyes if the snow got in your eyes. And that was scrubbing out air pollution that had come from Eastern Europe and blown over Scotland. So you get very strange things occurring sometimes. A lot of the acid rain problems that we had in northern Canada and in Scandinavia and elsewhere several decades ago were really acid snowmelt problems. And it was the storage of these chemicals in the snow and then the rapid release of them. And it's still a problem. In the Canadian prairies, we're very concerned about nitrogen and phosphorus runoff to our water bodies because they over-fertilize the water and we get toxic algae blooms as a result. And so we're trying to understand how they run off from snowmelt a bit better, and then also how farmers can manage their fields to keep the fertilizers in place on the soil rather than at the lakes downstream.
Well, let's talk a bit about snow cover depletion. Has this become a problem for farmers in Saskatchewan? Can it affect the wheat crop that Canada exports to help feed a hungry world? Has climate change altered snow cover?
Oh, it has. Around the world, many parts of the northern hemisphere have already lost 1 to 2 months of snow cover since the late 1960s. The first satellites measuring this were around 1970. So that's been noticed. In Saskatchewan, there 2 to 3 weeks of snow cover has been noticed. Snowfall used to be one-third of the yearly precipitation. It's down to one-fifth in many areas. So you have a longer summer, yet it's not wetted up very much. And it's much more difficult to get through that longer summer. So this year, we had a fairly low snowpack and an early melt, and then we had a drought. Just a few millimeters of rain from late March until June, into late June. And so the grains, the seeds that were planted in the spring didn't germinate, very slow germination, lack of growth, and it caused great problems for farmers. It was followed by a subsequent wet period, extraordinary wet period. So the crops finally grew, but they grew a month late in July because they didn't have that boost from the snowmelt water. And then it stayed wet, and then then the snows came in September. So the farmers weren't able to harvest the crop, and it was the worst harvest in terms of getting the crop off since 1980 in Saskatchewan. So not having that spring snowmelt at the right time just messes up the whole system through the summer and can create terrible problems in terms of being able to produce food in this part of the world.
And I've talked with scientists who say, too, that the changes in snow cover in the far north, where it's going away earlier and coming later, is exposing more dark earth and forest and then changing the reflection of energy to space and actually a factor in adding to global warming. It's a feedback effect.
Yes, yes. It's a very strong one. There's a strong feedback between losing your snow cover and then air temperatures, essentially. They're very hard for air temperatures to remain much above zero while there's still snowpack and snow cover on the land. Once it's gone, then the land heats up, and the air heats up above it, and then you rapidly get an increase in temperature. So that's seen everywhere, and some cases where snow packs are dropping, you have increased plant exposure, and the plants themselves are dark. These can be shrubs, for instance, and they'll heat up in the sun and accelerate the snow melt. So there's some feedback. So as you start to get shallower and shallower snow covers, then the exposed plants accelerate the melt rate, and you get a shorter snow season as well. And that's happening practically everywhere.
Another of your co-authored papers that caught my eye, this time published in 2018, it was titled Recent Changes to the Hydrological Cycle of an Arctic Basin at the Tundra-Taiga Transition. Look, you're talking about a giant band of territory that occurs almost right around the Earth, wherever there's land, and yet we know practically nothing about it. What is your research showing?
Yeah, that's an interesting area. So this is now the far, far north. We're close to 70 degrees north latitude. First, we looked at the trends since 1960, where measurements began in that area. And we actually see the hydrology slowing down a little bit. It's becoming cloudier over time. It's warming up, but not really wetting up so far. And so that surprised us a bit. But then we started, we used very high-resolution climate models to run the climate forward towards the end of the 21st century. And we saw some surprises. So instead of a slowing hydrological cycle, we saw a rapidly accelerating hydrological cycle. And this was because of almost a doubling of the amount of precipitation. And a lot of it occurring in winter, so it's falling as snow. So here the snowpack's going up. And then a very warm spring to give a rapid snow melt. And so the peak stream flows more than doubled in that region, which is fairly problematic because the culverts under the highways, the villages, the infrastructure is all designed for flows that are much smaller than what we're predicting for later in the 21st century. The other thing that's happening is the permafrost is thawing in that region, and it has been and will continue to even more rapidly. And permafrost is the ground which doesn't thaw in a normal year. So it's ground that is often composed of a mixture of ice and sediment. And if you dig into it, it looks icy, looks like dirty ice. And when that thaws, you get a collapse of the landscape. The trees topple over. If you have a town or a building, the building will slump over. Highway will collapse, and where there are forests will become open wetlands. So it's quite destructive as that permafrost thaws. This is exactly what's happening in northern Canada, northern Russia, many other areas. The model also showed a substantial increase in the thaw of permafrost and the increasing thickness of what's called the active layer. This is a layer of soil above that permafrost, which does thaw every summer.
And that is one of the scary stories that I hear when talking to scientists is the whole permafrost situation, the amount of carbon that's locked up in there that could be released, the amount of methane that comes up under these puddles or little lakes that form. It's a worrying situation.
Yes. Colleagues have measured substantial methane fluxes from thawing permafrost. And, you know, even back in the 1990s, we had an experiment in the Arctic. And we looked at the concentration of carbon dioxide in the winter snowpack. So we pull samples of the air out of the snowpack in the middle of the winter. And we were shocked that we were getting levels of 1.5 to almost 2 times the atmospheric concentration in the snow. And this meant the CO2 had to be coming out of the frozen soil over the winter, which meant that it was being released from the permafrost and that this was even happening when it was frozen. Perhaps cracking as it refroze in the wintertime, but it also meant that there was respiration by microorganisms carrying on even in the cold winter period. So this hadn't been considered in the estimates of greenhouse gas emissions from Arctic soils, and it's now very well understood, and it's really a serious problem for the world because those soils continue to warm. The microbial activity continues to increase, and the permafrost continues to thaw, and we're releasing carbon that was stored thousands of years ago to the atmosphere very, very quickly.
John, part of your life specialty is cold water hydrology. What is that?
Well, that's the hydrology regions that have some kind of a noticeable winter when there's a snowpack or maybe the ground freezes for some part of the winter. It's an interesting hydrology to study because you need to study the normal summertime hydrology, the evaporation, the stream flow processes, groundwater, runoff. But then you also need to look at snowmelt, frozen soils, and snow trapped in trees, snow that blows around in the wind, things like this. So there's a lot of extra complexity to it.
And regarding the problem of mountain water, where you just attended the summit, what can we do? Are there key steps to be taken?
Well, yes, there are. And the mountains are a great example of cold regions hydrology. But one thing it calls to attention again that we have to start to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to the atmosphere and get the concentrations of those gases back down. But we know that's going to take a while. So in the meantime, we have changing stream flows out of the mountains. We may have to build our dams differently or operate them differently. We may have to build different sorts of flood defenses around communities downstream of mountains or in the mountains. We may have to make different decisions about where we generate hydroelectricity or grow food by irrigation from mountain water supplies. And there'll be difficult decisions as ski areas become unviable in some areas, as our favorite spots to look at, famous glaciers, such as one can see at the back of Lake Louise, the Victoria Glacier, become invisible over time as they retreat. And so we'll lose the scenic grandeur of our mountains and the ecosystems there, as well as the essential mountain water supplies.
From the University of Saskatchewan, we've been speaking with Dr. John Pomeroy. He is really a founder of many water studies in Canada and around the world. John is part of a group of international scientists warning about the impacts of climate change on the mountain water that keeps billions of humans alive. You can find links to John's works and science in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. John Pomeroy, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Well, thank you so much, and what a wonderful interview. Good questions. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.